Hello, everyone, and welcome to Talk Nerdy. Today is Monday, November 22nd, 2021, and I'm the host of the show, Cara Santa Maria. Happy early Thanksgiving to my American listeners and to anyone around the world who wants to have an American Turkey Day. And also, if you are hearing this show right when it drops, then I want you to know that there are only 3 days left to contribute to a really important charitable drive, Vulgarity for Charity 2021. Vulgarity for Charity is an annual charity drive jointly produced by Puzzle in a Thunderstorm and Cognitive Dissonance Podcast, the collaborators on Citation Needed. And of course, you know them from The Scathing Atheist, God-awful movies, which I regularly contribute to. This is such an important pledge drive. So basically, or charity drive, I should say. I don't think there's really a pledge situation. It runs from November 1st through Thanksgiving, November 25th. So we're right at the tail end of it. I have shared about it on social media, but now I want to make sure that you, my podcast listeners, have a chance to contribute. So the charity benefits Modest Needs, which is a nonprofit organization that gives emergency grants to low-income workers who are at risk of slipping into poverty and for whom no other source of immediate help is available. So here's all you have to do. During the drive, if you give $50 or more to Modest Needs, you send a copy of your donation receipt to vulgarityforcharity@gmail.com with a request for a roast, a hilarious and an outrageous roast. You can request anyone or anything to be roasted, and the podcast crew will select 200 roasts of all the roasts that are submitted. Guys, the odds here are pretty good. So if you submit, you're probably going to be selected. And over several podcast episodes, they're going to do these roasts. And of course, if the person or the thing you want to roast is not famous, you should also send an image, a short description, so of course they can get a proper roast. Last year, Vulgarity for Charity raised $272,948.34. This year, they're hoping for $300,000 in donations for Modest Needs. And an anonymous donor has pledged to match all funds up to $100,000 for the duration of the drive. So every dollar donated up to $200,000 is worth double. This is huge. Make a donation right now to Modest Needs of $50 or more. Send your receipt to vulgarityforcharity@gmail.com. They will roast anyone and their roasts are brutal. And get this, I have agreed to be a guest roaster. So you may have Cara Santa Maria doing your roast. Super excited. There's not much time left. I hope you'll participate. All right, before we dive into this week's show, I also do want to thank those of you who make Talk Nerdy possible each and every week. Remember, Talk Nerdy is and will always be 100% free to download, and that's because I rely heavily on listener support from people just like you. I've recently completely reworked my tiers on Patreon. So if you go to patreon.com/talknerdy right now and pledge only $2 an episode, you get an ad-free version of the show. Woohoo! This is a really big deal. And if you pledge $10 or more, you join the private Discord server. If you pledge $25 or more, you get a shout out at the top of the show. And finally, $50 or more gets you a chance, not just a chance, not a drawing. Like, we will do face-to-face live chats. And by face-to-face, obviously, because of COVID, this is online. And obviously, you guys all live all over the globe. So I want to give a shout out right now to my top tier patrons. So those of you who are within the coolest person in the galaxy tier, I want to thank Ulrika Hagman, Leonard Prince, June Sapara, Gabriel Felipe Jaramillo Gonzalez, and Frederick Fast Markison, Dudas Infinitas, David J.E. Smith, Christopher Pitts, and Brian Holden. Those of you who are in the coolest person in the universe. Yeah, that's a big deal. There's only three of you. You're my extra special big, big thank yous. You include Rob Schreck, Mary Neva, and Daniel Lang. Thank you all so, so, so much from the bottom of my heart. You make this show possible, and you make possible episodes just like the one we're doing today. I know you're going to love it. I had the opportunity to sit down with Dr. Lee McIntyre. He's a research fellow at the Center for Philosophy and History of Science at Boston University. He's written several books, including Dark Ages, The Case for a Science of Human Behavior, Post-Truth, and The Scientific Attitude, Defending Science from Denial, Fraud, and Pseudoscience. But his new book, especially relevant for our times, is called How to Talk to a Science Denier: Conversations with Flat Earthers, Climate Deniers, and Others Who Defy Reason. This one's important. And I know you guys have been asking for it. Here he is without any further ado, Dr. Lee McIntyre.
Lee, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
So I have to tell you, when your book came across my desk, How to Talk to a Science Denier, I was like, ugh, yes, yes. Match made in, well, not heaven, but match made. I am so excited to talk about this with you because this is right up my alley. I think all of the listeners of the show have been struggling with this concept, have been struggling with this topic. And from the work that I do, both here on Talk Nerdy, but also on the other show that I co-host, The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, it's a big part of our work as sort of quote-unquote skeptical activists is science communication, and especially how do you even begin to communicate with somebody who doesn't agree with some of the basic premises, some of the, you know, that middle ground, that center ground, that sort of, well, we all want to promote logic and reason, right? Well, not always. So I'm just really excited to deconstruct with you to get to the base of this. But before we dive into the book itself, I want to know a little bit more about you. Like, how did you get into these topics? Because this isn't your first time writing about, you know, this idea of post-truth, this idea of science denial. This has been a big part of your career.
It really has. This book is the booster shot, if you will. I mean, I've got some other things out there that I thought were going to do the trick. You know, every time I write a book, I think, well, there, that ought to do it. And then things get worse. So I have to write another one. They're not all about the same topic exactly, but I have been concerned for quite some time with the problem of science denial. I'm concerned in general with the erosion of reason, but I think that science denial is in particular interesting because it really showed the pathway that people could use to deny reason on a number of other fronts. Because, you know, as much as folks like you and me and your listeners probably think that, you know, science denial is terrible, awful, and, you know, who could possibly believe it? It's been wildly successful. I mean, modern science denial started in the 1950s with the big tobacco companies, and it has been pretty much 60 or 70 years of uninterrupted victory for them. Whatever they have trained their sights on to undermine, to fight, to manufacture doubt against, they have succeeded. And then now the problem, in my view, has really metastasized not just to science denial, but to reality denial. So this is, I think, the most important work I'm going to do in my life, standing up for science and truth and reason. This is maybe not it is unusual work for a philosopher, but it shouldn't be. I mean, to be concerned with this, because it's not just theory, it's practice. And here we are. All of these things are being attacked, and it's time that we learned how to fight back and to do it effectively.
Do you find, I mean, gosh, so many questions arise for me, but the one that comes up right after what you said about sort of that it shouldn't be, but often is somewhat unique for a philosopher is, do you find, are there like-minded philosophers that you can engage with, that you can argue with, that you can refine some of these views with? Do you find that there are other people within your sort of subset of thinkers that are also grappling with this topic in a sort of scholastic or academic way?
Yeah, there's in fact a whole movement now in philosophy called public philosophy, where philosophers are trying more to do really two things. One is to write more clearly so that we're engaging the regular public. I mean, my last several books have all been trade books. They're not scholarly books, though they've got some footnotes in them. They're aimed at the general popular audience. But public philosophy is also about engaging with the problems of our time, you know, not just bringing people into the scholarly debates, but going out and seeing, you know, what are the issues of our time and how can we bring the philosophy skill set to that. So yes, there are other philosophers who are doing work on, you know, quite a number of things. This problem in particular. One of my main people that I debate with, that I talk about this with, is my friend Andy Norman, who just wrote a book called Mental Immunity.
He was just on my show.
Okay. Maybe that's why I'm on your show. Because Andy, Andy's been a friend for 40 years. We went to college together, and our careers have been fairly parallel in many ways, and we're concerned with some of the same things. He's really more concerned with the general problem of reason, and I've been more of a kind of a hedgehog with the question of science. They're related at this point, and so we talk about this stuff.
Absolutely. Yeah, there's sort of and we'll probably really parse this as we dig deeper, but there's sort of the process of science, and then there's the institutional knowledge that has come from doing the process of science for so long. And I think now we're living in a world where not only are people denying sort of outcomes and consensus, but they're also denying just science, like the reason, like you said, the logic, the reason, the basic like procedures that are utilized by philosophers, by scientists, by academics, by, people who prioritize those kinds of things, logic and reason. But before we really sort of parse that and I think dig into it, I'm trying to remember, there was another question that really came right to the front of my mind when you were responding to my question about your previous books and about sort of how you got into this world as a philosopher. And I'm talking in circles while my mind tries to find that other question that I didn't bother to write down. And I think it's lost, which is fine. So I want to know, living in sort of a post-truth world, living in a world where, it came to me. Good, good, good. I'm wondering, is your general thesis, and not of the book, but just sort of your thinking, or is one of the theses that you have sort of been utilizing as you operate, the idea that science denial as a sort of concerted undermining, as an agenda-driven movement, that it's less about the individuals that get swept up in the denial, and it's more about the architects. This is something I often talk about on the Skeptic's Guide, like holding the architects' feet to the fire, and whether that be a regressive right kind of political movement, whether it be a fundamentalist religious movement, whether it be, like you said, like big tobacco, where they had a very specific agenda, whether it be oil companies, that there are people who have orchestrated science denial specifically. And then there are people who fall victim to their rhetoric.
That is exactly right. And many people don't realize this. It's easy to get mad at the science deniers, at the believers, because the believers are the ones sitting across from you at the Thanksgiving table. They're the ones saying, why don't you take ivermectin? They're the people who are, talking about all of the things that science deniers talk about that, enrage you. And then you kind of try to talk them down if you can. But they are victims, and they're victims of disinformation. Denialists are created. Nobody wakes up one day and wonders, I wonder if Bill Gates put biochips in the vaccines. That's fed to them. That's propaganda. And so there's a sense in which you might think even that science deniers deserve a bit of empathy. And we can talk about that a little bit later if you like it, in the way that you try to reach them to convert them.
Yeah, but almost like cult, like people who are members of a cult versus a cult, the cult leader. Yeah.
But the people who need their feet held to the fire are the people who are creating the disinformation. I've often said that science denial is not a mistake, it's a lie. Somebody has to tell that lie. Somebody has to profit from that lie to try to create an army of believers. So the one thing that drives me crazy in watching television coverage about COVID denial, mask denial, vaccine denial, is that the media tends to treat it as if it were misinformation, as if this were all just a great big accident and we don't know how we got here.
Right.
We got here because we are the target of a propaganda campaign. So this is, as you said, the orchestrated, the perfect word. This is an orchestrated campaign of information warfare that is designed to get people to not just disbelieve certain things. That's too small bore. It's to distrust. So it's not just to doubt the particular facts about climate change or the particular facts about the vaccine. It's to get you to distrust the people who are trying to tell you the facts.
Right, because and the institutions that those people are in. Yeah.
So science denial is not just about undermining climate change. It's about undermining the way that scientific evidence that backs up climate change is discovered and tested and, you know, put out there. So that's why it's so virulent and it's so important to push back. And I think you're exactly right on the money in looking at it that way, because if you're trying to fight back against science denial, you know, I've written this entire book, How to Talk to a Science Denier, and you can do that and it can be effective, but you're treating the sick when you're doing that. How about preventing the disease in the first place? And to prevent the disease in the first place, you've got to go after the creators of disinformation and the amplifiers of disinformation, not just the believers of disinformation.
Absolutely. It's sort of like, I feel like a lot of times when we have these intense conversations in the media about, like, you know, Facebook and their responsibility, or these different platforms, or the individuals who are sort of spreading around the propaganda. And although, don't get me wrong, Facebook, I think, has a lot of blood on their hands. Ultimately, I worry that we're approaching this the same way we've been approaching the never-ending war on drugs, which is going after the low-level dealers as if they are somehow responsible for drug trafficking. Like, we're not going to the source. We're not actually holding the whether it be the governments, the campaigns, the individual perpetrator, like the large kind of spokes. And, you know, we have pretty sophisticated ways to look at media spread. And we know, like, who on the internet is responsible for the most. Yeah, like, we're good at that now.
I think that you're right in the sense that if you could stop the creation of disinformation, then there wouldn't be anything to amplify. There wouldn't be anything to spread. But I think this is where the analogy with the mid-level drug dealer breaks down. Because what Facebook and Twitter and YouTube do is they don't just propagate the message, they amplify the message. There was a study out of the Center for Countering Digital Hate, which found that 65% of the anti-vax propaganda on Twitter was due to 12 people. Now, yes, if we could shut up those 12 people, but cynically looking at who those 12 people are, and some of them have a financial interest, can we actually do that? It's not just a question of deserve, it's a question of where's the pinch point. And I think that the pinch point is social media. That's what makes makes science denial so much more virulent these days. It's that this disinformation is getting out there. You know, without the amplifiers, the people creating the disinformation wouldn't have the ability to reach such a large audience. And there's one other bomb I got to drop here, which is that these creators of disinformation are not all just domestic folks that we can reach. Some of the worst creation of science denial, disinformation, is from foreign intelligence. So, you know, how are you going to stop Russia from creating disinformation about the COVID vaccine? You really can't. I mean, that's an information war, and the U.S. military is gearing up. You know, they know how to fight an information war. But it's the amplifiers that I think deserve a lot more scrutiny. If we can shut down the creators, yes, but the amplifiers, I think, deserve more scrutiny than we're giving them.
I think that's an important point. You're right. And ultimately,
I mean, yes, it's about shutting it down, sure, but I also think it's about holding people accountable. It's about, you know, like I'm always so confused as to how the very direct link between, let's say, a Jenny McCarthy spewing anti-vax rhetoric, or even like an Andrew Wakefield, let's go even, you know, more to the source, an Andrew Wakefield spewing anti-vax rhetoric, how, like, why have these people not gone to prison? Why have these people not, you know, at least gone on trial and at least had an argument made for the amount of harm that is literally resting on their shoulders?
It's hard because it's subject to the law of whatever country they're, you know, they reside in. And as I pointed out, not all of it is coming from the U.S. I mean, Andrew Wakefield is a British physician. He was stripped of his medical license and, you know, is a pariah as far as the medical establishment is concerned. But he's a hero to anti-vaxxers. He goes,
yeah,
to
like
these,
doesn't matter because their whole thing is like to eschew.
Right.
Like medicine, or yeah.
So it's really hard. I mean, yes, there needs to be accountability, and I mean, really, I think of it this way: one of the greatest ways to hold somebody accountable is to expose them. Wakefield was shown not just to be sloppy, but fraud.
Yeah,
there was an investigative journalist, Brian Deere, who
had him on my show. Yeah,
who yeah. did the work, right?
Yeah,
to
yeah.
show that Wakefield wasn't just a bad scientist, he was committing fraud. I think that does some good, as it would, you know, to if you could actually demonstrate to them, if people would sit still and listen to the argument that, you know, Russian intelligence is behind a lot of the disinformation about the COVID vaccine, because then a magical thing happens. Then the people who are being duped, nobody likes to be duped. And, you know, now maybe you won't convince them that they're being duped, because that's hard to do, right? Mark Twain said that it's easier to fool somebody than to convince them that they've been fooled, right? They just, their ego's involved. But I've always thought that if you could just shine a very bright light on the people who are creating the disinformation, like was done with the tobacco executives, like was done with the fossil fuel executives, but, you know, try to do it in real time, not wait 40 years. Wouldn't that help? I think it would. Look, I think we need a lot of oars pulled on this. We need to go after the creators. We need to go after the amplifiers. We need to have empathy, but still go after the believers. You know, yes to all three of those. This is a big enough problem that I don't think there's any single solution that's going to fix it. We have to do all of the above.
I think you're right. And before we sort of dive into how specifically to talk to, you know, the person at Thanksgiving dinner who is pushing the ivermectin narrative, I'm wondering what your take is on sort of the newest, or I don't know if new is even the right word, but the most recent wave of this denialism rhetoric, which, you know, we've experienced here in the U.S., most obviously through the sort of microphone of or megaphone of Trump and Trump's associates. But of course, in you know, there's Duterte, there's, you know, Bolsonaro, there's all these individuals all over the world who are kind of holding up those banners. And my biggest fear is that what historically might have been a science denial problem, and what, you know, we were discussing might even be a reason denial problem, has become so entrenched and has worked its way into, like you said, it's about developing a sense that we can't trust not just the data, but also the people, but also the institutions. And now there's a weird distrust of the media itself, which is to me the scariest sort of final pin, because as much as we want to believe that science as an institution is sort of self-correcting, you know, it's a peer-reviewed process. It's still done by people. And of course, so is media. And there are always going to be cultural ebbs and flows of, you know, the way we do science, the why of the science. But the whole point of the media is supposed to hold people accountable.
It is a tough one, because what we're facing now is, as I said at the opening, is reality denial.
Yes, reality denial.
And I in my book Post-Truth, I define post-truth as the political subordination of reality. Used to be that science denial was about money. Look at the tobacco companies. They didn't want to prove that, they didn't have to prove that smoking didn't cause lung cancer. They just had to raise enough doubt so that we would delay for 40 years while they sold cigarettes. It was Naomi Oreska's wonderful book, A Merchants of Doubt. This was the point. It's worse now, because science denial has become politicized. Look what happened with climate change. That's about money, but it's not just about money anymore. It's also about politics. And once it becomes politicized, once you start to choose up the us versus them team, then it's, you know, as I said, the foot soldiers aren't making any money on it. The fossil fuel executives are still making plenty of money on the on climate denial. But the foot soldiers out there are not making any money, but they know which team they're supposed to be on. And so they're, you know, passing on the disinformation and believing it, and it makes it worse for all of us.
God, it's such a pyramid scheme.
It is. And so what really has to be done, I think, is, you know, the primary thing, the first thing, is to simply to recognize the spot that we're in. We're in a spot where the risk is authoritarianism. The risk is not just science denial or reality denial. Because, and why do I say this? It's because the way this is going is straight out of the authoritarian's playbook. Read Tim Snyder, read Jason Stanley. They make the argument that the best way to control a population is to control their information source.
Mm-hmm. And we see that in North Korea. We see that even in China. You know, we see places where, people are only fed what the government is comfortable with them being fed.
So that's what they're doing. They're attacking the media. They're attacking the, look who Trump attacked, the scientists, the media, the intelligence services. He's attacking the truth tellers, because once, and by the way, creating distrust about them, because doubt can be answered by evidence, but distrust cannot. Once you distrust the truth tellers, then you get cynical. And then,
right, because whatever evidence they provide, you
is a lie.
It's a lie. Yeah, it's part of a global conspiracy.
Right. So where do you go for accurate information? You go to the authoritarian dictator, right? That's the danger that behind all of this, because reality denial is not just done for fun. It's done for a political purpose, and that political purpose is fascism.
I've always been confused by the mental gymnastics that it takes, though, to, yes, doubt, deny. I don't trust, you know, I don't trust CNN anymore, and I don't trust the, like you said, the CIA anymore, and I don't trust, you know, the different like organizations that were the truth tellers, yet I trust this asshole. Like the mental gymnastics that it takes to go, but that guy, the guy who's the clear authoritarian, he has all the answers. Like, where does that leap come in where people go, but him I trust?
But because, I'm smiling here. You could maybe hear it, because I was just reading a scientific paper, the title of which was, "He may be a liar, but he's my liar." Right. Yeah. That's the point. It's they're on the same team. It's the it's
oh, so about, that goes back to the tribalist stuff that was built in at the beginning.
It's about identity. It's not yeah. just about ideology, because then it's, well, does this person's ideology match mine? And, you know, if not, then maybe I don't believe them. But if it's your liar, then even if you know they're lying, you kind of feel like, well, their heart's in the right place. They're at least fighting the good fight. They have the same enemies as me. Oh and God, that is the point at which truth dies. That is the point at which it doesn't even matter whether the person is saying something that's true, because they're saying something that helps your team. And that is the end. That is, you know, Snyder said it best, post-truth is pre-fascism. That's what this is gearing toward, I am afraid.
I see that so often with, I'm going to get a little personal here. I see that so often with my own father, who, you know, long story short, for the listeners probably already know this, I was raised in Texas. I grew up in the, you know, the heart of the Bible Belt in North Texas, to a Mormon father. I left the church quite early. I consider myself an atheist, a very progressive. I moved to LA, you know, blah, blah, blah. The rest is history. But one of the things I really struggle with when I communicate about these issues with my own father is that he's a very smart man. He's an engineer. He is very pro sort of academia. He really respects what I do for a living, and he respects he respects knowledge. But at the same time, he has these fundamentalist religious views and these very staunch ties to his Republican identity that often override reason. And so we'll engage. Like, that's the nice thing about my dad, is that we can engage. And sometimes it gets hot, and sometimes, you know, tempers fly. But when we engage, we always get to a pinch point where sort of the argument breaks down, and it's like, well, it's just what I think. It's just how we think. And it frustrates me to no end, because I can see that identity, that desperate sort of like, okay, the ideology is no longer quite as clear, and I'm having a hard time articulating it, but my leaders told me this. And if I disagree with this, then all of a sudden the entire fabric of my belonging starts to unwind, and that's not safe for me.
Can you point it out to him in just the way you just did?
Oh yeah, but
that's the part that you just said.
But the part that I think is really hard is that when you reflect that back and there are emotions involved, the defensiveness of, like, when somebody, you know, it's almost like being told you're in a cult. Yeah, like, no, people don't want to hear that.
Is. I mean, I've often said that in talking to a science denier, when you challenge their beliefs, you're challenging who they are. This is not just what they believe. This is their identity. But And you know, there was this, people sometimes think that science denial is just about intelligence, but as you point out, it's not.
No, my dad is a very smart man.
Sometimes the smart people are the ones who are the hardest to convince, because they're able, through reason, to, you know, cherry pick off, and, you know, they've read a lot and they know how to defend themselves through argument.
He believes that evolution is real. It's just not the cause of speciation, which, by the way, is the whole point. You know, like, because he wants to make his respect for science and institutions sit nicely with his religious views. So he does a lot of mental gymnastics to make that work.
So I'm intrigued, because it sounds like he's redeemable through argument, through the engagement and the empathy that you have for him, through the relationship that you have for him. I wonder what might happen if you said, you know, Dad, it sounds like your view here is based on faith. And I'm not talking about his religious views. I'm talking about, you know, when he says things about, you know, scientific things that he doesn't believe because they clash with his Republican identity. I wonder what might happen then, because he obviously respects science and he respects evidence, and there might be some daylight there. How does he feel about climate change?
I think he thinks that it's real. I think he's one of those people who thinks that we need to be careful about where we put our money and that why should the U.S. bear the burden? You know, most of the sort of talking points that you hear from the more moderate Republicans who say, yes, climate change is real, but are we really the drivers? And even if we are, is it really our responsibility as Americans to pay for the rest of the world? You know, those kinds of arguments, which are frustrating. But I think that part of the difficulty here, and, you know, I hate to throw all religion under the bus. That's really not what I'm doing, which is why I want to say more fundamentalist religions, I think, are more responsible in this particular case. But I think the problem comes down to the fact that although my father, and I think lots of people listening probably know people like this, although he respects reason and he respects evidence and he respects science, he actually respects faith more. And I think that he thinks faith is a good thing. And he has been taught throughout his religious journey that there are certain things that we can't have answers to and that, you know, we just have to believe. And when, you know, and whether it was passed on by the Bible or the religious sort of people, the prophets, you know, the individuals who are carrying on the quote word of God, what they say is irrefutable. And it's the easiest way to go ignore everything else. I'm an authoritarian who said this, and you have to believe me because that's what your religion is telling you.
It's fascinating to me. I mean, I've always thought of faith as, for the person who has it, a kind of evidence. It doesn't convince anybody who doesn't have it, right? How would my faith convince you? It doesn't. But to the person who has it, maybe that feels like I open my eyes and I see the color red and they open their ears and they hear God. You know, maybe it's something that they just can't ignore. But Norm MacDonald died recently, the comedian, and he was a Christian and, you know, a reflective person. I mean, I don't know if you're a fan of his comedy, but I mean, he talked. He was not an easy person, even, you know, as a comedian. There was an interview that I saw where he was reflecting on his religious faith, and he said, somebody asked him about some particular belief, and he said, well, I don't believe it. I'm not certain of it. I choose to believe it. And, you know, what did he mean by that? He saw faith as a choice, not as just something that, you know, you hear the voices or you don't, but that it was a choice that he was making. And that sounded, and the reason I paid so much attention to that, because I'm not a religious person, but the reason I paid so much attention to hearing what he said there is that that sounded like trust. That sounded like a, well, leap of faith, right? That he was saying, he wasn't saying, I have no choice. That's the voice that I hear. He was saying, I choose to believe this. And I found that really fascinating because that means that you can at least have a conversation about it.
I agree,
About why do you choose to believe it? What do you get out of it? Is that a rational choice? Is it something that comes with other consequences, et cetera, et cetera? It opens the conversation up, I think.
Yeah, it carries a sense of like volition and personal responsibility.
Yes.
And whereas I worry that with my own father and maybe with a lot of the, you know, relatives of people who are listening, there is almost I often refer to it as a sad sort of experience that I think both of us love each other, but also in some ways feel deeply sad for the other. Because he thinks I won't be redeemed. He literally thinks that because I'm an atheist, I am not going to have eternal salvation the way that my soul is not going to be saved. And in his view, that's what matters, right? So how sad for him and me, because I feel like he has these blinders on and there are whole aspects of his experience while he's alive, which in my view is the only thing that matters. It's the only thing that is, that he's being duped and that he's not been able to come out of that sort of cult. And I think it's one of those really interesting things where the two of us look at each other as if we have some sort of
knowledge that the other doesn't have access to. You know,
I'm just eating this up, this kind of thing, because the thing that I think is the most dangerous, whether it comes from a perspective of faith or of science or of reason, is the hubris to think that we know the answer with certainty, especially about empirical questions, which we cannot know with certainty.
No, but we can only approximate based on the available right. evidence that we have.
And as fallibilists, change our mind when new evidence comes forward. But especially about questions where there is no evidence whatsoever. I have absolutely no clue how to assess the probability, how to even fathom what it means to say that it's more likely than not that there's life in other worlds, or that something happens to us or doesn't after we die, because there's zero evidence. No one has ever come back from the great beyond to tell us what it was like. And I know all the arguments on both sides. I've taught philosophy of religion, and I know people who are religious and people who are not. But it's hubris that scares me, because takes a page from Socrates, right? The real enemy of knowledge is certainty. It's false knowledge, right? It's not ignorance. Ignorance can be overcome through learning, but when the person thinks that they know the answer, that's dangerous. And by the way, into that category, I'm going to say something maybe that's a little blasphemous here for your listeners. I put Dawkins into that category, because I read Dawkins and he is so sure that he knows what happens to us after we die. How does he know? How does he have any clue what happens to us after we die? He does not know. There's no, why would there be, suppose he's got a knockdown argument for the fact that God doesn't exist, or why we shouldn't believe that God exists. Suppose he's got a knockdown argument for that. What is the connection between that and the conclusion that, therefore, when we die, nothing happens? I mean, if I sat down for dinner with Dawkins, here's the question I would ask him. You don't need God to explain this world. Why do you need God to explain the next one? I mean, this world is pretty amazing. We've got stuff and life and consciousness, and it's, when it's not terrible, it's wonderful. How do you know what happens to us after we die? He doesn't. I don't. Nobody does. That's not an excuse for fantasy. It's not an excuse for taking this, I think, leap of faith where you just think, oh, that's what I have to believe because it's the only thing that redeems, you know, my psychology. But I think that we grow in wisdom when we accept uncertainty.
I think you're exactly right.
You talked personally about your relationship with your dad. I'm going to, you're drawing all my secrets out of me. I'm going to say something now on air that I've never said in any of the podcasts I've done. I had cancer last year and I am in remission now. But it caused me to reflect on the problem of uncertainty, because when you have cancer, you will do anything to get an answer about your future. What is going to happen to me, right? It's almost worse than the cancer. It's worse. It's almost worse than the physical effects. And I am privileged to be able to say that because I had a form of cancer that didn't have as many physical effects as some do. And the fellow cancer survivors out there, I feel you. But it is what dooms you in the middle of the night when you wake up at 2:30 is the lack of evidence or certainty or projection into the future. And I have had to learn not to let that bother me as much. It still bothers me. I still wake up. It's the little man that lives on my shoulder and will till the end of my days. But it is important to embrace the idea that there are things that you cannot know and that the future is uncertain, and to learn how to live with that.
It's so interesting, Lee, that you say this. One thing that you probably don't know about me is that I'm working on my PhD now. I'm like an old grad student because I, you know, sort of left academia and then went back much later. And I'm working on my PhD in clinical psychology, and I'm specializing in psycho-oncology. And so right now I work in a large cancer center here in Los Angeles, and I do therapy with cancer patients. And
so you've heard this before.
Well, the interesting thing is that one of the very common themes that I bring into my work is a conversation. And it's so funny because I'm not religious, but it's a conversation about the Serenity Prayer. Although with secular patients, we just lop the prayer off of it. This idea of really working towards affecting change when there is change to be affected, sitting with equanimity when we cannot know and there's nothing we can do, but then knowing the difference between the two.
It is so important to gaining peace, because in my case, hypervigilance is what saved me. If I hadn't been the kind of person who was hypervigilant and a pest and, you know, what if, and pushed my doctors, pushed them, the kind of cancer that I had is usually not caught early, and people, you know, by now I would be dead. But so that hypervigilance saved me. But now it's useless. I mean, now, yes, I have to go in for a test every 90 days, but, you know, what can I do more than that? Go in every 10 days? I mean, there's no clinical outcome that's going to be different. And so,
and the scanxiety doesn't serve you. There's nothing you can do about it.
So how do you live during those 90 days between tests? It's been the hardest thing to learn how to live every single moment through day 89 before that next test, because otherwise I'm just wasting my life. I'm just giving in, right? But it's been the most difficult thing I've ever faced, because, you know, you think I'm a philosopher, I should know how to deal with this. I didn't know how to deal with it, because it's not, you know this from your practice, it's not completely rational. It's emotional. It's, you know, there are other aspects to it.
As it should be. Yeah. Yes. As it, you know, as is the human condition. And,
that's,
you know,
right.
I practice from an existential humanistic perspective. So of course, that's a huge part of what, you know, I'm not like a cognitive behavior therapist. I'm not all about symptom reduction and strategies for a symptom, but I'm about, let's get to the heart of why this stuff matters and why it's, you know, keeping us up at night.
That's it. It's, and, you know, I wish more people did the kind of therapy that you do, because, I mean, I didn't. I tried to do it on my own. And
well, it's also hard to find practitioners, you're right, who do this. And most cancer centers don't have them available. It's you know, and it's not just like we talked about the scanxiety and what is the scan going to show, but a lot of the work that I do is also helping with some of the empathy training around the fact that our own providers don't know. Like, prognostication is as much an art as a science. And ultimately, it doesn't really serve us. I was just working with a patient, and one of the things that we sort of came up with together, which I thought was so beautiful, was that prognostication is very similar to forecasting the weather. It only becomes really accurate the closer you get to death. But the farther you are away, like, it's a crapshoot. We don't know what the weather's going to look like in 3 weeks.
And it drives you crazy. My guru on this is my childhood friend, who is an outlaw biker. We've been friends since we were 10, grew up in the same tough neighborhood, lived very different lives, but he is my brother. And I trust him. And he has helped me to turn off the anxiety and to focus on how to accept the uncertainty. It was the day that I said to him, how can I live a happy life when the future is uncertain? And he said, that's why you should live a happy life, because the future is uncertain and maybe this is all you've got, so do everything you can with it. That's a lot of wisdom for him to impart to me. But he has, because of his different life experience, he has lived, you know, through a lot of turmoil and knew what he was talking about. He'd never lived through cancer, and I hope he never does. But he was the, you know, other than my my wife and children, and the other cancer survivors, he was the person who helped me through it the most because he had that, I don't know, fatalistic attitude. Is it fatalism? It's a form of acceptance of uncertainty.
Yeah, and it's a very, you know, reality-driven view that sort of, it's what I tell my patients all the time when they ask why I do this, or when I, you know, when my friends say, how do you do this? How are you not depressed all the time? Why do you work with people who are, because I work with people who are just got their diagnosis, all the way to people who are in survivorship like you are, all the way to people who are dying, and, you know, everything in between. And what I always tell them is that, like, in a way, it's like I get a view inside of some of the most life-affirming philosophical insights that many of us don't have the privilege of developing until we're faced with what we call a boundary experience, something that sort of takes you into an ontological way, a very existential way of thinking. Many of us don't have those insights until we lose somebody, until our own reality is shaken. And I get to experience those insights daily from my brilliant and beautiful patients. And it's like, it's almost like I'm not supposed to be here, but they're letting me in. And it's such a privilege.
It is. I've had the same experience with other cancer survivors. They're the best people in the world.
Oh, yeah, I love it. And you know, this sort of this whole conversation and sort of the framing around it takes me back to this idea when you were talking about Dawkins and you were talking about certainty versus uncertainty and sort of the serenity prayer and living in the gray area with equanimity. And it reminds me of a phrase that we often use on the Skeptic's Guide, neuropsychological humility. Sort of like knowing our cognitive biases, knowing all of the ways that our brain plays tricks on us, the more that we're aware of the fact that we are not tape recorders, you know, and we have like all of these fallibilities, it helps you maintain a sense of humility about your own mind. And I think that that speaks to my own personal religious views. You know, we were talking about Dawkins. I myself am a pretty staunch atheist. But when people say, how can you be so sure that God doesn't exist? My answer is always that I don't believe there is no God. I just simply don't believe in God. And I think that those are two very different things. And when they say, well, then aren't you an agnostic? My response is, we're all agnostic. It's a redundant label. Nobody knows. In my view, you either live your life as a theistic agnostic or you live your life as an atheistic agnostic. And I live my life as if there is no God. I make choices and have behaviors as if God didn't exist. But that doesn't mean I know any more than a religious person knows.
Who is the one who said that everybody is an atheist about all other religions except theirs?
Exactly, right? Like most, yeah, in America, at least, most people are not polytheistic unless they subscribe to a handful of very specific religions. But the dominant, you know, the monocultural sort of religion here, the Judeo-Christian, it's monotheistic. So yeah. They're atheistic about all the other gods.
Well, all the others, and then people you call atheists is just, well, and that other one too.
Right. And just one more.
Instead of all the others but one, it's just, you know, all the others.
But you're so right about this idea that I do think it's an important distinction. It's not that I fervently believe there is no God. It's that I simply don't believe in God. And I do think that's an important distinction to make because it does show a certain level of humility. Like I try my best. And we all have hubris and we all struggle with that, but I really try my best to check it and to maintain that neuropsychological humility because by definition, anybody who studies science knows, by definition, things that exist outside of the natural world, metaphysical things, are not subject to the scientific method. We cannot know.
I like the way you framed it because it's really, you think about how scientists, why they believe something. They believe it tentatively. They believe it based on the evidence. They believe they're maybe skeptical at first, but once the evidence is sufficient, then they give their assent. But understand that they should be open-minded enough that if future evidence comes forward to suggest that they were wrong, they'll change their mind. Right. I think that that's, in fact, the essence. I call it the scientific attitude. That's the essence of what it means to be a scientist. And so what you're really doing is approaching your beliefs, not just about science, but all your beliefs in that same way. And I have to say that this brings me back to this question of how to talk to science deniers, because one of the most important things that I found through personal experience and speaking to them is that you have to approach them with an attitude of calm and empathy and respect. And part of that is humility. Part of it is understanding. And here's the thing. If you express that, it will make them like you. It will build trust. And if you think of science denial as a breach of trust, building trust is crucial for convincing somebody to give up their denialist beliefs. Because yes, it's hard. You're trying to get somebody to change their identity, maybe as hard as getting them to change their religion or their political beliefs. But is it possible? Yes. And how would you do it? I think you do it by admitting that you don't have all the answers, that science is not about proof and certainty. And if they have the view that science, you know, that you have to prove that the vaccines are safe before they'll take it, that's not a scientific view, because you can't prove that aspirin is safe. You can't prove that anything is safe. Things, they probably taken other vaccines where they didn't have that standard. So I think, you know, reaching out to somebody in a humane way with the idea that none of us have all the answers, I think that that resonates on a human level with people, and they will perhaps begin to open up. Certain amount of science denial is based on fear and alienation and polarization, just this feeling that you're against me and why would I give in to you? You can defang the snake by listening to what they have to say. Just simply, I went to a flat earth convention one time. Simply by listening, I think I built trust. And people can only monologue for so long, and then they'll say, well, what do you think? And we actually had some interesting conversations.
Yeah, it reminds me what you're saying of the sort of central tenets of Rogerian person-centered therapy. Carl Rogers is a very humanistic voice within the therapy movement. You know, he had these tenets. He basically said, when I sit down with a patient or a client, I attempt in every interaction to utilize empathy, to have unconditional positive regard, and to maintain a non-judgmental stance. And in doing that, in sitting with somebody, and I like to also add to that a principle that I think is really important, and that's the principle of charity. Why assume in each interaction that a person has a nefarious plot? Why not, from the very beginning, say, this person is doing this because it makes sense to them, because it brings them meaning or purpose or whatever the case may be, and they're doing it out of a place of good. And if I can make that assumption and operate under that assumption, I'm going to flex my empathy muscle in a way that really, I think, lends itself to better communication and better understanding.
Isn't that amazing?
I know. It's like, and I firmly believe, and I say this to all of my patients and I say this to all of my friends, empathy is not a gift that some people have and other people don't. It is a skill that we have to learn.
It is. And after writing this book, in the process of writing the book, but also after, I've started to recognize the symmetry between the methodology that I recommend in this book and what's used to talk people out of cults. Daryl Davis is a blues musician who talks people out of the Ku Klux Klan. They give him their robes. He's done it 200 times. Read a book by Eli Saslow called Rising Out of Hatred, about a young man who was a rising star in the white supremacist movement, who was talked out of his beliefs by a group of Jewish students who invited him to Shabbat dinner at their college once a week and basically talked him down out of his white supremacist views. People can do absolutely amazing things, and our beliefs can change because beliefs are not just about facts. Beliefs are about community. Beliefs are social. And this is whether they're reasoned beliefs or not, by the way. So, I mean, this applies to all of us. But the amazing things that I've noticed, you know, because I read these accounts of the hardest of hardcore science deniers who give up their beliefs about climate change, about anti-vax. When does it happen? It always happens. It's the same story every single time. They were engaged in conversation with someone that they trusted who treated them with dignity and respect. And over more than one conversation, they shared facts that the person then later came back to on their own and decided to give up their beliefs. That's how it always happens. And it's the hardest thing to do.
It's a humanistic interaction. It is.
It's the hardest thing to do when you want to throttle somebody for not wearing their mask, right? Across that Thanksgiving table. It is very hard to do it. And I have to say, I'm not particularly good at it in the, you know, Rogerian or you think of it. There are other people who are much better at it than I am.
And sometimes it's harder to do with your own family.
It is. Yes. Yeah. No, you bring up a great point there. I mean, because they already trust you.
Right.
So you're already on first base. But then there's the, well, I don't have to respect them. I can just be blunt, but that doesn't always work.
Yeah. It's, oh gosh, there's so much sort of, I think, wealth in what we've been discussing, and it continues at a depth that almost, like, the more you think about it, the deeper it goes, and I think it reinforces why it's so important to be an ambassador for reason, to be an ambassador for science, to be even the reason that I like to be an ambassador for nerdiness or for atheism. The reason when people say, well, why do you even use the label? It's like, it's not because I'm trying to deconvert, and it's because I want other people to see that we're not all the same. We're not all monolithic. And like, I'm an atheist too, but I try to be a good person. And I want people to interact with an atheist that they think is a good person. And to me, that's an important step, you know? And I think one of the points that you just made that I want to reinforce from a personal perspective is that we can change our minds. Like, I was raised Mormon. I left the church. And when people ask me about what was the thing that made you realize, I don't know if I was ever actually Mormon. I don't know if my mind was ever made up. I think I was just trying to be a good kid and please my parents. And I think the doubt and the questioning was always there. So I sometimes wonder if sort of the more intellectualization, the more sort of logic and reason and non-religious views were central to me. But what I can say is that as I get older, I am not as much of a logical positivist as I thought I was. I am much more of a, you know, constructivist thinker. I very much, even though I'm still an atheist and I'm still a skeptic and I still really respect the scientific method, I very much believe that our realities are constructed based on our experience, and it's important for us to maintain humility and respect and empathy for people who have constructed their own reality, even if it's wildly different from ours.
Well, and yes, and I think one of the main reasons for that, this is something during the pandemic, I got a rescue dog, and my other two dogs had just passed within 6 weeks of one another, and I was just devastated of, you know, everything going on in my life at that point. And I got this dog who is half husky, and he needed to be walked every day, 5 miles. And, you know, and I thought, wow, okay, well, we're going to do this. And during my walks, I mean, I had a chance to really just kind of get into this rhythm and think. And one of the things that occurred to me was, how do we know that the human brain is even capable of understanding reality? How do we know that? I mean, how many neurons do we have in the human brain? How many different configurations could there be? Maybe we are ants on a globe that can't understand what the globe is. Maybe we don't have the intellectual capacity or whatever we would need to really understand the basic principles of physics or reality. Even if they were told to us, maybe we wouldn't understand them. We wouldn't not just not have the vocabulary, we wouldn't have the mental capacity to understand it. That kind of deep humility I think is important when we're engaged in this I'm right, you're wrong dialogue with somebody. And I say that not because I don't think that I'm right, that the COVID vaccine is a great thing and that everybody should take it, you know, unless they're immunocompromised or they're allergic. That, and I think that the people who are shilling ivermectin, that's just wrong. And no, there are not microchips in the vaccines. And it's just, that's ridiculous. So, I mean, I can get in a high dudgeon with the best of them. But the important point is to just kind of, I think, pull back from that larger perspective where if you were looking at an ant crawling on a globe, you might think, well, from his point of view, you know, what's he thinking? He couldn't understand quantum mechanics. He couldn't understand all this other stuff. Maybe we're the same. Maybe we're the same way. Maybe reality is so subtle and so interesting and so incredible that we can't understand it. And so that's important to keep in mind. The hubris, the lack of hubris, the presence of humility in talking to people. Standing up for science and reason, I think, is to stand up for humane values. It's to stand up for the idea that, you know, learn what you can, revise as new evidence comes in. And that's a deeply humble view because you're admitting at the outset that you don't know everything. It's not Euclidean geometry. It's not deductive logic. When you're studying the empirical world, there are things that you not only don't know, but that you may never know. And it's really hard to channel that when you're having a heated conversation, and I can't do it, and I don't know many people who can. But reaching out to people, I firmly believe that reaching out to people on a human basis is the only way to go. It's the only way that we have any sort of hope of changing their beliefs. And even if we don't change their beliefs, I think we are better for it. Because if we just insult somebody or we scream at them or we denigrate them, I think that diminishes us as well as them.
I think you're right. And the truth is there are going to be people for whom there will always be, with whom there will always be conflicting views, right? Yes. There will always be somebody in your family that no matter what you do, like you said, the persuasion, the art of persuasion is simply not going to take, take hold.
That is right.
But wouldn't you rather have mutual respect between you? Wouldn't you rather get along? Like, I agree to disagree with my dad all the time. And there are deep, difficult feelings that I carry with me. But at the same time, I actually enjoy his company. And I think that that's like the best thing you could hope for.
Isn't that interesting? I mean, the problem comes in when somebody's beliefs hurt you, when they're, you know, like, oh, I don't believe in wearing masks, so I'm not going to wear a mask. Well, gee, that might get me sick. So I mean, that's where the real clash comes in.
Yeah, I'm very lucky that my dad is vaccinated. But you know what I mean? Like I said, he's got the nuance there.
Right.
But you're right. When somebody, and that's when, you know, people have to make decisions. Public health issues, public health decisions are sometimes a little bit more firm. And that doesn't mean that there won't be another day where you can spend, you know, good time together. But if you have to say, sorry, mom, you can't come over because I have a baby or I have a young child who can't get vaccinated. You know, that's a personal choice.
I think that's right. I mean, you just, I studied these cases of people who change their mind and why they change their mind. One of the most interesting cases I heard recently was a fellow who said to his friend, look, I love you. You're my friend, and that nothing is ever going to change that between us. But until you get vaccinated, you're not going to come in my house. And that worked. That convinced the friend to get vaccinated. And the thing is, I don't think that the fellow who said that was doing it necessarily just with the kind of cynical ploy, oh, maybe this will convince him. I think he was just saying, look, these are my values. This is who I am. And as much as I respect you and love you, I'm not going to let you tread on that, which was, which is important. And in talking to science deniers, it's important to realize when you try to convince them, sometimes they feel like you're trying to take something away from them. You're wrecking their community. You're wrecking their identity. So it is threatening. And by the way, even using, don't use the word denier. I mean, I know I used it in my book, but probably no science deniers are ever going to buy my book and become converted by it. It's written for the allies of science. And I think it's important not to mince words. They are deniers. But, you know, in the way that you speak to a science denier has to, you know, not be insulting or threatening because they're already upset.
Right. It's like my dad thinking that, you know, in his view, if he was trying to convert me, like calling me a blasphemer or a heretic is probably not going to go over well.
No.
Even though in his view, that's what I am.
No, it ruins the relationship.
Yeah.
So you've been hearing some funny noises for a few moments. It's because that dog I was telling you about with the 5-mile walk. He just woken up and he's scratching his nails against the base of my bookshelf.
Oh, he's ready, huh?
No, he's not ready to walk. He's just letting me know. Yeah, I'm up here, buddy. He's on a pretty good schedule. I got a second rescue dog after him who's a little bit older, and she doesn't like to walk as much, but she joins us usually. Maybe not for the full 5 miles, but
I was gonna say my little guy's legs are about 3 inches long, and he is coming up on his 12th year of life. And so a 5-mile walk sounds like I'd be carrying him the last 3 miles of that walk.
Yeah, you would. You would.
Yeah. Well, gosh, Lee, I think that number one, this has been an enlightening, a meaningful, a deep, and a lovely conversation. Number two, I want everybody to run, don't walk, to check out this book, because I think it's just such an important insight to have, an important tool to have on your bookshelf. It's called How to Talk to a Science Denier, Conversations with Flat Earthers, Climate Deniers, and Others Who Defy Reason. Lee, thank you so much for being here with us today.
Thank you. I really enjoyed our conversation, and thanks for pulling all my secrets out of me.
And everyone listening, thank you for coming back week after week. I'm really looking forward to the next time we all get together to talk nerdy.